Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten, and money-making Manhattan. You're listening to Bashani Radio App, the number one independent app for podcast. Download for free for iPhone and Android at the App Store.
This is Dante Lee, and you should check out Z, the SEO Queen.
Hello, Bashani Radio, iHeartRadio, Google Play, and iTunes. This is Z, the SEO Queen.
And Ernesto Comodo from 907K.
We want to invite you to attend the webinar series, How to Thrive and Grow in 2021. This workshop series is going to be awesome.
And for just $100, you'll get marketing strategy, website, SEO, and social media.
This is a steal, a great value for business owners of all sizes and types, whether you're B2B or B2C.
Yes, this is a great value. You get a domain name, hosting, website, SEO, and social media marketing.
Yes, this is a great value.
Where can you sign up for these workshops?
It's online and easy to register for. Just go to howtothriveandgrow.eventbrite.com and you can sign up for all workshops or the ones that fit your schedule between now and February. Check it out now. Just go to howtothriveandgrow.eventbrite.com. We can't wait to see you there.
This is David Spradley, and you should check out Z, the SEO Queen.
Do you have an online business or want an online business but lack the team or the expertise to get on Google page one? Did you know that 33% of all Google search traffic clicks the first result only? Do you want to get more traffic to your website, social media profile, or just want your video to get more hits or go viral? Well, you need to contact the SEO Queen Digital Marketing Agency, where you are more than just a number. You can't lose with the SEO Queen. More visibility, more credibility, more profitability. Visit theseoqueen.net for more information. That's theseoqueen.net. THESEOQUEEN.net. That's THESEOQUEEN.net.
The SEO Queen, the SEO Queen, more credibility. The SEO Queen, more visibility. The SEO Queen, more profitability. The SEO Queen, the SEO Queen, the SEO Queen, the SEO Queen. The SEO Queen, more credibility, more visibility, more profitability. The SEO Queen.
Welcome to the SEO Queen Tech Show, a podcast to help you get more credibility, visibility, and profitability through inspiration, technology, and marketing insight. This podcast is for professionals and entrepreneurs who are looking to get more customers, clients, and patients. We are on Bashani Radio, iHeartRadio, and iTunes. Bashani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. You can listen to the SEO Queen Tech Show on any mobile phone or tablet device. Also, as a thank you gift for listening to the SEO Queen Tech Show, you can go to SEOQueen.com and download the free ebook, 101 Ways to Improve Your Marketing and Sales. So today's guest is a scientist that needs not a whole lot of introduction, but he is the guy who discovered biodegradable plastic. What a heck of an innovation. So I want to present to some and introduce to others none other than Dr. Donald White. If I had to do it all over, knowing what I know now, I probably would have been able to wrap my mind around sacrificing my social life to do that. But But I didn't really have a social life through high school. So,
It was just one of
I mean, I didn't have really much one in graduate school either, so don't feel bad. I mean, it was tough.
Yeah, because in high school, so in high school, let me tell you what I did, Dr. White. In high school, I had no life. I had no boyfriend. I had no fun, hardly. All I did was focus on getting into Harvard, which I did not get into. I got accepted to Yale, UCI, UCLA, UC Berkeley. And
really, you got into Berkeley? So I'm from the Bay Area. I tried to get into Berkeley and didn't.
Yeah, I got accepted to Berkeley, but I ended up going to MIT. Once I got to MIT, how was MIT?
Yeah, how's Boston? I mean, really more so Boston than MIT, I guess.
Well, I really didn't spend a whole lot of time in the city. I was truly consumed with college life. Like, I left on occasion maybe to get my hair done.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe go to a party.
I got you.
But I did not say, oh, it's Saturday. Let me go out to Boston Common and do blah, blah, blah. Like, no.
Do whatever, yeah.
Yeah, I was on weekends. I Saturdays, I would sleep in, get up, do some homework. Saturday night, go to the club, get home, get in the bed, get up, go to church. After church, chill, eat, homework. Yeah, that was pretty much my life.
One of my frat brothers' one of my frat brothers, his wife is an MIT graduate. Her name is Dr. Tamara Floyd Smith.
Tamara Floyd Smith. I do not know who that is.
Yep. She got her PhD from MIT. So I guess it was a different space because she was there for graduate school.
Yeah, I met some, you know what? I may know her by face, not necessarily by name, because I did get to know some of the Black grad students.
Which is good, because I know it's not a lot of you all.
Child, let me tell you. When it doesn't matter if you Black, you lived in Senior House, East Campus, whatever. When I was at MIT, I was going to stop you and play 20 questions. Because I wanted to know who you are, why you here, what you doing. We going to be friends. That's it.
Right.
That was my expectation.
That's real. I mean, especially in that space. No, that's real. I think for me, it was a whole lot different because I went to a historically Black college. And so for me, it was like, I don't know, a culture shock the other way. It was the first time I've actually seen second and third generation college students and people saying that they were going to be doctors and then actually following through and becoming doctors. You know, it was interesting.
Which HBCU did you go to?
I went to Tuskegee. I'm a Tuskegee graduate.
Oh, okay. Tuskegee, that's in Ohio?
Alabama.
Oh, Alabama.
It's in Tuskegee, Alabama. It's in rural Alabama. It's not too far from Auburn University, which I guess is the big, they always put these HBCUs like not too far from a white school. Almost always. It's right next to a huge PWI.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I was at Tuskegee.
If I could do it all over again, I would consider going to a HBCU. I would love to have had that experience.
It is definitely an experience.
I think I probably would have had a better view of the world younger than I did. I think I was super naive when I was younger.
So for me, it gave me, so what did it do for me? It gave me perspective. It allowed me the opportunity to grow up. It allowed me the opportunity to grow up academically.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I wasn't really in a space where I was academically mature. I was, if I would have gotten into a Berkeley or let's say, MIT or Stanford, I wouldn't have excelled. I probably would have failed out. And I think that is simply because of, it's not that the school was easier, because it wasn't. It was, you know, it was just, it's hard. In a lot of ways, it's probably more demanding because, you know, there's no excuses, right? It's like, oh, you're picking on me because I'm Black. Everybody here is Black. So what's your excuse? Like, what do you have to say now? And so there's, you know, your teachers are Black. The president is Black. The provost is Black. The financial aid counselors are Black. Everybody is, they look just like you. And for me, coming from California, that was the culture shock. You know, it was like, oh my God. And so one thing it forced me to do was to be like brutally honest with myself and say, hey, you got deficiencies in your learning. You got things that you didn't grasp. You got concepts that you just didn't get. And I don't know if that was because, you know, I was running around the Bay Area being a knucklehead, or, you know, if it was, you know, I just, you know, the quality of the schools, I'm not even going to put it all on the teachers because, you know, we weren't doing our part either. The culture for like inner city kids, you know, growing up in the quote unquote ghettos of America, the culture for, you know, public school is just different. I think I was talking to someone and I was telling them, I was like, we looked at our teachers as our adversaries. Mm-hmm. Like they weren't, you're not here to help me. You know, you don't live in my neighborhood. You don't look like me. You don't go to where I go to grocery shop. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, you're saying all of these things. You know, we got ADD or we got ADHD or, you know, we got, you know, we're some kind of social work case or something like that. And, you know, I grew up with kids that just had so much brokenness in their homes, and not everyone. But right. For the most part, there was just so much brokenness, and we dealt with like teen pregnancy. My middle school had a daycare at it.
Your middle school?
My middle school had a daycare at it. It was like 5 kids up in there, or 6 kids in the daycare. It might have been more than that, but you know, I very vividly recall going to my friends, my peers, going in to the daycare playing with their kids. My high school had a daycare at it. You know,
did you say your middle school or your high school?
Both. My middle school and my high school had a daycare.
There were kids in both middle school and high school who had kids.
Yes. Yes. You know, I knew kids who had kids in the 8th grade, kids who had kids, you know, that summer going from 7th to 8th grade, get pregnant and then have kids the following year while we in school. And then what happens? Because their parents are working every day. So there was like little programs and stuff where, you know, the kids would actually come to school with, you know, the kid. I mean, it's literally babies having babies. I mean, that was kind of like that era. I think that's gone down some. It's not as like teen pregnancy is probably not as prevalent as it was, I don't think. But, you know, I think it still happens, and it was happening pretty frequently. Mm-hmm. You know, I got people in my family who had kids in like 9th grade. You know what I mean? So, It's weird because now, you know, it's weird being only 14 years older than your child. That's strange. You 30 and they're in high school. You know what I mean?
Right.
that's
wild.
That is wild. But I mean, that was also reality. And so, you know, we walked through the metal detectors every day. We didn't have on-campus security. We had police. You know, the Richmond Police Department was who policed our schools. You know, we had the different, even the middle school, we had different.
How far did you grow up where the Fruitvale Station incident occurred?
Okay, so Fruitvale happened in Oakland, and I'm in Richmond. So it's about 4 miles north. We're 4 miles north of Oakland. So, if you think of the Bay Area like a cul-de-sac, and San Francisco, if you use your hand as that cul-de-sac, San Francisco being the thumb and the knuckle on your index finger would be Oakland. And right at the tip of that would be like Richmond. So we're not far at all. So, you know, Coach Carter and all of that kind of stuff that happened at Richmond High School. That was high school my mom and dad went to. My aunts went to school with him.
Oh, you wow.
Know, aunts and uncles. Yeah. So, you know, Richmond is not that big. It's 100,000 people in the city, but you know, the Bay Area itself is like a megatropolis. So you have all of these cities that feed into what is known as the San Francisco Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And you have bridges that connect the city because it's a peninsula. You have the Bay Bridge that connects Oakland to San Francisco. Then you have the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge that connects the other side of San Francisco, right? So Richmond to the other side of San Francisco. And then you have the Golden Gate Bridge that connects, which is the heart of the Bay, that opens up to the mouth to the Pacific Ocean, that connects San Francisco over to the San Rafael side. So you can go from San Francisco to San Rafael, San Rafael to Richmond, Richmond back to Oakland. I mean, you know, across the bridges. And then you have like Vallejo, which is a little bit more north than us, going towards Sacramento. You know, Sacramento being like an hour away from where we are, about 50 minutes, something like that. And, you know, so it's not in the Bay, but, you know, the culture is very similar because they're not too far away from us, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's we're not that far. I was at home in Richmond when that happened, looking at the Channel 2 news when it was like the BART police had killed. So BART stands for Bay Area Rapid Transit, and it's the train system. So he was at Fruitvale at the train and watching this stuff where they had, you know, shot and killed Oscar Grant. I just couldn't believe it. Like,
right.
Like,
that's crazy.
Yeah, that was crazy. And that, you know, that was before Sandra Bland, Philando Castile, that was Mike Brown. That was before everything, you know. I think the Oakland especially, but the Bay Area has a bad history of the police over policing, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. You know, so that police brutality is kind of there. The police being in the schools is there. You know, the kids fighting and shooting is there. The murders is there. The drugs, the crime, it's all there, you know. All of those aspects that we see throughout Black communities everywhere is definitely in the Bay Area. And so for me, I was just like a normal kid. But then you had these science programs like at UC Berkeley and Stanford, and more especially UC Berkeley. They really served the Richmond community. So like they would, like the kids would, they would come in these different programs and have like science on Saturdays. And sometimes they would come to like the middle school or the, you know, the high school, whatever. And they do little stuff with us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so some of the things we were doing, like I remember doing gene editing in high school. We took in my biology class, or it wasn't biology, it was science. We took the gene that makes fireflies glow, and we introduced it to bacteria.
Oh, wow.
And we made our bacteria cultures glow in the dark.
Oh, wow.
I did that in high school at John F. Kennedy.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I thought so too. I mean, but you know, you got this school, right? So those are like the cool days, right? Those are the fun days at school. And we went to school today. I actually had a good day today. We did something kind of, you know, where we felt like
you learned something. Time. Yeah.
Right.
It was worth your time going. Yeah.
Most definitely. But that wasn't our day to day. Mostly it was come in here, you know, through the metal detectors. And I think they got rid of the metal detectors at my school. I'm not sure, but when I went there, we definitely had them. So you come through the metal detectors, you know, we didn't have any textbooks. There was no books to take home. We had lockers, but again, there was no books to take home. So what was the point of a locker? We put our backpack in there, whatnot up in there, but like, you know, papers and maybe some notebooks and pencils or whatever.
Did you guys, I mean, you guys really didn't have individual computers. They didn't have computer carts then. They just had the library and maybe one really computer in the class or.
Yeah, we didn't really have a whole lot of money. So we did have like a computer lab where there was, you know, some computers there that the kids would come in. We all had to share. But like you're just now actually seeing, since I got out of college, you're just now seeing like these grants and programs where HP is donating computers to school and Apple is doing all of this stuff where they're donating computers to schools and stuff like that. You're actually just now starting to see this stuff, you know.
I think you're seeing that because they're realizing if they don't train the next generation of workers, they're going to have a serious, serious labor shortage.
Well, yeah, we already actually seeing that now, right?
Right. Not enough people in the cloud computing, not enough people in tech space. So I have a question for you.
Sure.
Dr. White, what inspired you to launch the brand, The Chemist, and You're a Chemist Too? What is the inspiration behind those books?
Very, very easy question. So when I was doing chemistry in school, so let me take it a little further back. How did I actually get into science? I always loved it, but I was not in the space. Again, we were in the hood and none of that is cool, right? It's like learning and science and being smart. None of that is actually cool. What's actually cool is being popular, getting girls, dressing nice, having money. That's what was cool. School was almost like hell. It was almost like being, imprisoned almost. And it was just a huge burden, especially when I got to high school. It was just this burden being there because none of us wanted to be there. None of us. Some of us was actually using school as an escape to get away from, whatever was going on at home, whatever woes. You had some of the kids' parents were strung out on drugs. Some of them were being raised by relatives. Some of them was in foster care, And so you had a lot of brokenness. I always wanted, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a chemist. I wanted to be a scientist. I didn't really know what the different disciplines were, like chemistry, biology, and physics, math. I didn't really know what was what, right? And how each group of scientists worked or operated. I didn't know that. Nor did I know anybody or have anybody in that space. But I've always wanted and aspired to win the Nobel Prize in chemistry. I wanted that. That was something that I've always wanted, right? And so I was like, yeah, I'm gonna win a Nobel Prize. And at first, so that's always
you still young enough to go after that. Most of the cats that win Nobel Prizes
are super old.
Yeah. Old as dirt.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's tough. I
met one Nobel Prize winner in physics at MIT. Really? Mm-hmm. I forget his name. But I met him and he signed something for me. I forget his name, but
that's pretty cool. I don't know any Nobel laureates personally. I've never met a single one. I probably wouldn't be able to stop cheesing ear to ear. For me, it's the scientific equivalent to meeting Michael Jordan. You know what I mean?
Right. So, you would totally, that would make you fanboy.
Right. Yeah, I'd probably blow it. Right. So but here's the thing, and I don't want to come off as arrogant, but I don't only want to win it once. I want to win it twice. I want to be a multiple time Nobel laureate.
So this is a perfect time for us to switch gears into my next question. This question I've been wanting to ask you since we've met.
Okay.
Met on Clubhouse.
Clubhouse.
I wanted to ask you, what inspired you to come up with biodegradable plastic?
Oh, okay. So
I mean, that to me, that is such an innovation. It's like, why doesn't everybody know your name? Why doesn't everybody know Dr. White? And why aren't we using your innovation everywhere? So that's what really I want to know.
Yep, that is a really good question. So what happened was I was actually working with so I come from a long line of surface chemists, right? Which my academic lineage leads back to UC Berkeley, right? So a couple of surface chemists, begat a few people, and then here you end up in Alabama, and then you end up getting me, right? So we were working with nanocellulosic materials, and I was actually incorporating nanocellulose into plastics, making what we call nanocomposites. So you have your traditional plastic, and what I do is I take the sugars which is what gives the plants their dexterity, the strength or rigidity, right? Cellulose, that's what it is. And so I was incorporating cellulose into the plastic, but I did it in such a way, one night, 4 o'clock in the, well, it was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in the lab, and I was really tired, and I was like, man, okay, so let me go ahead and mix this with that real quick so I can go, and I'm gonna just come back in the morning. Like, I'm tired, I'm ready to go home, right? And I mixed the wrong beaker in the wrong vial, and, you know, I realized that my cellulose suspended in my polymer, like completely suspended. And I said, whoa, wait a minute, what just happened? And so we did a little bit of more investigation, a whole lot more studies, and I'm a product of a center. So I actually got my degree funded by the Center of Sustainable Nanotechnology. So at the time I was in one of the largest chemistry centers in America. So you have all of these universities coming together doing highly collaborative research. So you have Wisconsin and Johns Hopkins. And at the time we were collaborating with within the center, two groups. So we Bob Hamers, so the Hamers group, and we were collaborating with Howard Fairbrother, who's at Hopkins, and they're environmental chemists. And Hamers is, I think they're also surface chemistry. I'm not actually sure exactly what their field of expertise is, but I know he worked with complex metal oxides to help solve the exploding battery problem with Samsung. So to make a long story short, we did a triple blind study through the universities to see exactly what was going on. So the first plastic that I made was high impact polystyrene, which is what you see in laptop casings, right? And okay. I also used ABS, which is acrylonitrile butadiene styrene. So, which is what you see in Legos, right? It's the shiny hard plastic, right, that you see in Legos, right? Right? And so
I bought some Legos over Christmas.
Really? That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I bought some Legos to teach my son his word so he can have that tactile learning going on.
That's clever. Yeah, a lot of people are actually doing stuff like that. It builds a whole lot of different skill sets. So I was working with those, and since then I've made probably about 2 dozen polymers and polymer blends, so all different types of plastics at this point, right? One of the things that we found was we did a biodegradation study, and we found that the cellulose itself, well, I mean, not the cellulose, but the cellulose-based plastic was starting to produce biogas. And so we were trying to figure out, well, how is it possible that it's producing biogas? So what this process did was I didn't make a biodegradable plastic. It took existing plastics and made them biodegradable, non-biodegradable plastics, and made them biodegradable. And so we were going for patents. So we had to word it at the time in such a way, because the patent hadn't been published yet, right? So we had to word it in such a way, like Tuskegee University researchers discover biodegradable plastic, or come up with biodegradable plastic. Well, we actually took a plastic that was not biodegradable at all and made it biodegradable. I like to call it defect chemistry, because essentially what
wait, back up. So you took, so it's like you took like a Lego.
Yep.
And decomposed it essentially.
Yep. 60 days. Not completely, but it starts to, so your typical Lego will biodegrade eventually over time. But that time frame is about, it starts the biodegradation process after 1,000 years. Well, plastics were first synthesized in like the 50s, I think. And I think the first one was a cellulose-based plastic, cellophane. And since then, every piece of plastic that we synthesize is pretty much still in existence if it hasn't been incinerated. So we use UV degradation. So they put it in the sun And to break it down, but it breaks down to what we call in microplastics. And those are much more reactive and detrimental to the environment. So the birds and the fish and everything eat the microplastics. So what we're seeing now is like the wildlife are eating the plastic, and then we're eating the fish, and then now we're ingesting the plastic. So they've actually found for the first time plastic in the placenta of a pregnant woman. And so you're starting to see, you know, this plastic show up absolutely everywhere. Now, our process actually takes the cellulose and puts it, incorporates it into the plastic, and it fits at the molecular level into the void spaces. So if you think of any solid material, it's 90% air. And whether it's amorphous or crystalline, you know that the arrangement of those atoms have bonds. Those bonds have lengths. And in between that, you have air, space, right? So they might be so closely compacted together that it looks like or has the appearance of being completely solid all the way through, right? But if you look at it holistically, you know that the wall, the floor is 90% air, right? It's like 90% space right there. It's just the arrangement of the atoms.
Right.
And so if you can actually get something into those void spaces at the molecular level, what you can do is you can allow bacteria to get in there and break those bonds. It's all about energetic. So in chemistry, what happens is normally the energetically most favorable thing, unless there is a certain condition to which dictates something else, and then it's all about stability, right? So
right.
In this case, what is the energy of activation, or how much energy would it take to break a bond? You know, and so for these plastics, ABS and HIPS, they have what we call phenyl groups or styrene groups. They have these benzene rings and they're attached. Well, because of resonance, and I don't want to get too technical, but because of resonance, it's almost impossible to break these bonds. You know, these benzene rings are, you know, dang, they're indestructible. You know, they're really, really strong.
Wow.
You know, they take a lot of energy to break because the electrons can disassociate to the next atom and form resonance, which gives them a certain amount of strength. And so it's hard to, one of the things that we love about these plastics with styrene groups is they're strong, right? They're lightweight, they're strong, they're durable,
right?
And they're relatively cheap to make, right? But right. That's also one of the main reasons why, you know, they're not good for the environment, because they're dang near indestructible, right? And, you know, these things weren't synthesized with an end of life perspective. So how can we make them better? And so that was the whole premise of the research. What I discovered was is that there's a give and take, right? So anytime you add something, there's a give and take. We added nanocellulose, but you know, what did we lose actually? And what I learned was we didn't lose much. We gained thermal stability by almost 30%, and we gained mechanical strength by about 14%. In some cases, depending on the ratio of cellulose to polymer. Well, cellulose to polymer, but cellulose to synthetic polymer to plastic. And you know, I did some talks on it. Couldn't really get too in-depth because a lot of the information was proprietary, but we did some talks on it. We went after patent, and you know, I think the reason why the world hasn't, because some people know about it, but I think the reason why it's not so widespread is because of the politics. So if you look at these plastics, they actually come from the oil and gas industry. So they're petroleum-based plastics. And, you know, one of the things I try to tell people is that so many more things come from just oil and gas than just gasoline. You know, most of the solvents that we use in the lab, most of the plasticware, you know, if you think about your clothes, your carpet, I mean, there's just so many polyesters and just, some of the ester groups and hydrocarbons that we use for everyday life that we don't even realize come from the oil and gas industry. And so a lot of people think this infringes upon that, but they don't really understand it. It doesn't. We actually take two waste products. So the thought process was taking the waste product from the agricultural industry and the waste product from the plastic industry and putting them together for a new novel product with an end of life perspective in mind, so that in, you know, 10 years, what would be the environmental impact? You know, little to no, that's the goal, right? Little to no environmental impact.
Right.
And so that was the whole premise of that. And so some research has been done. I'm sure, you know, more peer review is going to come out of it because, you know, we've only published like a couple of papers. I published one with Hopkins and then and Wisconsin, and then, you know, my dissertation. And so there, we have some other papers that we are waiting on the patent to clear, and then we're going to publish those as well. But I mean, I think that, you know, the scientific community needs to then vet and scrutinize, you know, the research. We stand by it, but it still needs to go through that peer review process, you know, to be deemed credible. That's the true soul of scientific research. And so for me, I think that, you know, people don't know about it yet, but I think they will. It might even be Nobel worthy one day. We'll see.
Well, I think your research answers a critical problem, a critical world problem. And if we can integrate your, you know, patent pending methodology into the life cycle of plastic, I think that would have, you know, some long-term benefits for mankind. Now, did you say that plastic has been found in placentas?
Yeah, so recently, so they've been, it's been popping up pretty much everywhere. They found it in, I've read some articles where they found it in urine. I've seen where they found traces of plastic in feces. So there was one particular article, and I can't remember, was it the Kaiser Foundation? Can't remember exactly now, it escapes me, but where they said they found in human feces, they found five, the average human has, you know, 3 to 5 different types of plastics in their feces. It doesn't surprise me. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, a lot of these reactions that go into synthesizing these plastics, some they use like UV curing or a radical reaction, if you will. So it's initiation, propagation, and elimination. So you initiate the radical, you propagate it, and then you eliminate it by adding the polymer chain. Or in some cases, they add halogens, like chlorine and fluorine. And so, yeah, so, and they're also, they also use different catalysts as well. So they got chemical catalysts as well that they use too. But what happens is that when you put these plastics, let's say you got a water bottle and you put these plastics in the sun, the very first thing that happens is the reaction starts back. There's no way to really stop it. Stop that reaction. So
plastic, you know, seeping into the water bottles.
Right, correct.
Wow. Well, Dr. White, I just want to say it has been a pleasure talking to you. I really think my listeners on the SEO Queen Tech Show really need to hear about your innovation and your journey. I mean, 30 minutes is just not long enough. It's not long enough. 30. Yeah.
Because we didn't even talk about my carbon capture technology.
No, we didn't talk about that. And we didn't really go cover in depth. Book. Yeah, we didn't cover your books. And I mean, yeah, so you really have a story to tell. You really have a story to tell.
A few more minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to come back. You know, I would love to come back. I'd be honored.
Yeah, let's make that happen. We're going to do a part two, Dr. White.
Okay.
And we're going to do a part two. And for my listeners, you've been listening to the SEO Queen Tech Show, where my guest is the genius Dr. Donald White.
Thank you. You're so
who
kind.
is innovating in not only in chemistry and plastics, but he's also encouraging young people everywhere to see themselves as chemists and to pursue science. And we here on the SEO Queen Tech Show, we are definitely a proponent of science and technology. We want our listeners and their children to take it serious. So how can people connect with you?
So I am available on Facebook and Instagram under the trade name The Chemist. So that's D-A-C-H-E-M-I-S-T. And so I'm on Instagram as D-A_C-H-E-M-I-S-T, The Chemist. You guys can reach out to me either on Instagram Messenger or Facebook. And I'm also on Twitter. Though I don't have much of a Twitter following yet, but I just got on Twitter. So that's the Kim first. So D-A-C-H-E-M, the number one S-T. So The Chemist was actually taken by a rapper in Houston. So I had to switch it up a little bit and implement the one as the I. So yeah, you can find me on those platforms. I'm also on Clubhouse as The Chemist. And check me out.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. White, for coming on to the show. And
And visit yourachemist2.com and pick up your book. All of the ebooks are coming with a free live session with me. So the book is an experimental book and it's going to come with a live session. So if you get the ebook, you get a live session with me. But I highly recommend you getting the physical book because you'll have that longer.
Wow.
Yeah.
You heard it here on the Tech Show with the SEO Queen, the SEO Queen Tech Show. Thank you so much. Now, Dr. White, can you do me a favor?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you say this is Dr. White and you're listening to the Tech Show with the SEO Queen?
Yes. This is Dr. White, and you're listening to The Tech Show with the SEO Queen.
All right. Thank you so much.
Like that?
Yeah, I like that. Thank you. You put a little sauce on that. Thank you.
I try to put a little sauce on there.
Yeah, you put a little sauce on that. I heard that. Yeah, we're going to have you come back. And until next time.
The SEO Queen, the SEO Queen, more credibility. The SEO Queen, more visibility. The SEO Queen, more profitability. The SEO Queen, the SEO Queen, the SEO Queen, the SEO Queen. The SEO Queen, more credibility, more visibility, more profitability. The SEO Queen.
Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Stan, and money-making Manhattan. You're listening to Bashani Radio App, the number one independent app for podcasts. Download for free for iPhone and Android at the App Store.